Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and of course, you know how to subscribe to us. And if you like, leave a positive note. Also, a reminder that I've started a new daily newsletter, The Morning Shots, and if you subscribe to the other Bulwark newsletters, you will probably receive it. If you're not subscribing, you can do it, and the added benefit of it being free. Every morning, we have the quick hits, we have the cheap shots, and we have the deep thoughts. I have to admit that I have most fun with the cheap shots, but there are deep thoughts. And one of the deep thoughts that we have already highlighted was a piece, What Changed My Mind About Climate Change, by Jerry Taylor, who is the president and the co-founder of the Niskanen Center, which has been singled out as doing some of the most creative public policy work in Washington, D.C. these days. And Jerry Taylor joins us once again on the Bulwark Podcast. Good to have you with us, Mr. Taylor.
Well, thanks for having me, Charlie. It's always delightful to be on this program.
Well, you know, you were one of our earliest guests on the Bulwark Podcast. I think I told you this in person, that we got a tremendous amount of response to that conversation. And look, I mean, you're brilliant and you're interesting, but I was very interested, like, what was it that really seemed to trigger that kind of reaction? And I think it was something we're going to be talking about today. Someone who talks about something that changed their mind, because nobody ever changes their mind these days. Nobody ever was willing to acknowledge, you know, for years and years and years, I argued X, and now I've, you know, decided that perhaps having looked at the evidence more closely, I'm going to modify my point of view. And I think it was that thought process that you talked about that people found so interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that it spoke to some people. I mean, after all, there are a lot of reasons why people don't change their mind. First of all, as David Hume once wrote famously, reason is a slave of the passions. And if your passions move in one direction, particularly on a given issue of public policy, you're going to harness your reasoning ability with all its might to justify holding that line. You know, so that's human nature. That's not left or right. That's the way we're hardwired. And then, of course, the second reason a lot of people don't change their mind, particularly people who are engaged on a daily basis in the political realm like you and I are, is that if you change your mind on an issue that has, you know, that is really fundamental to your political identity, you risk losing friendships, jobs, social circles. You pay a price for that. I mean, generally. And that price could be exile. And for a lot of people, they get more meaning and self-worth, self-satisfaction out of their, you know, their social relationships than they do with the, you know, the heightened sense of being right about an issue. And so for a lot of people I think I was this way, there's an inner policeman that checks and balances any tendency you might have to go off in a dangerous direction. So, for instance, and this might resonate with you, Charlie, or some of your listeners, a few years ago when Thomas Piketty came out with his book about the returns to capital being greater than the returns to the economy, that the returns to capital were greater than the general returns in the economy, and that this leads to increasing inequalities of wealth, most people I knew on the right immediately just went to battle stations, right? It was just job number one now is rebutting Piketty. Not to, you know, take a look at Piketty's arguments with an open mind and to see if they're correct. After all, if they're correct, it doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the moral case for capitalism one way or the other. You just have to acknowledge there might be more inequalities present than you might have realized in the past. But for most people, they have that inner policeman that prevents them from engaging too seriously in arguments that they don't share, because they know that there's nothing good that lies down that road. I mean, what are you going to do if you're an employee at the Cato Institute? You decide that Piketty actually has the stronger part of the argument. You probably are going to have to find a new job at some point. And rather than find yourself with that moral quandary, you cut off the internal conversation completely.
No, exactly. I mean, that paycheck is often attached to that. So that's a great segue, because as you mentioned in this article that you wrote for us, you spent most of your big chunk of your professional life from 1991 to 2014 at the Cato Institute, and one of the centers of your life was arguing against climate action. right? You were the director of natural resources study and an executive VP. So, I mean, you were the guy, you were the face of the, hey, let's not do that much because we can handle it. Global warming or climate change isn't going to be that damaging that we need to take X, Y, and Z steps. And so you did this for years and years and years. And when did you start to develop doubts?
Well, I began to develop doubts a little bit after a decade into this fight. From 1991 till the early 2000s, I was absolutely certain of my position. But a number of things happened from that point forward, not one of which was decisive, but together they proved decisive. The first thing that occurred is that I was on a TV show. And I don't remember exactly what show it was, but it was one of the major networks, CNN or MSNBC or something. And I was debating Joe Rahm. And Joe is a atmospheric scientist. He's of the left. He's an old sparring partner I had. And I went on the show and I offered a talking point that had been popular at the Cato Institute. It came from a former colleague of mine. He was a climate scientist. And he said, look, it's been more than a decade since James Hansen testified in front of the United States Senate. In which he argued in 1988 that if we continued down the current road we're on, we go with a business as usual path, that we're going to see a tremendous amount of warming. And he offered projections about what that warming would look like, you know, with his computer modeling. And I said, Joe, it's been more than a decade. We haven't, you know, adopted policies to address climate change. And what do you know? The warming's only been about a quarter of what James Hansen says it should have been by now, which tells me that these computer models run hot and that the climate is just not quite as sensitive to greenhouse gas loading as we thought it was. And we can look at the data and see that. So I'm not saying climate change isn't happening, but it seems to me that it's not going to prove nearly as severe as you're arguing on this show. So I went into the green room and Joe said, well, you know, have you ever actually read that testimony? And I said, a long time ago. I said, but this is based on testimony my colleague had just given to the United States Senate not too far back. And he said, look, do me a favor. He said, go back to your office then and look at that testimony again, because here's what you're going to find if you bother to do it. He said, what you're going to find is that, strictly speaking, what you said was correct. That was scenario A that James Hansen offered in his testimony. And it was off. He said, well, it was off because he greatly overestimated the amount of greenhouse gas emissions we were putting in the atmosphere. And a lot of that had to do with the testimony occurring before the Montreal Protocol was signed, which reduced a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. We've also seen a rise in the natural gas industry, which displaced some coal. And he says, the bottom line is Hansen overestimated the amount of emissions. You can see that in his data. And because he overestimated the emissions, he overestimated the warming. He said, but he also offered a couple of other scenarios, Jerry, you know, in that testimony. And at the time we were having this conversation, it was scenario B that was closest to the mark that he offered, as far as the emissions we've seen since 1988. Since you can look at scenario B, where he postulates some modest degree of policy intervention, giving us an emissions profile that looks pretty close to what we've actually seen since 88. He said, and Jerry, he gave a computer projection using his modeling about what kind of temperature increases we'd see if we went down that road. And he said, they're pretty much spot on. He said, now, so the point is, you just went on this show arguing that his models run hot, the climate's not all that sensitive. And it's utterly disingenuous, because if you look at that scenario B, which gives us an emissions profile that we've pretty much seen since that testimony, his projection was pretty accurate. He said, now notice it took me about 5 minutes to unpack this for you. I don't have 5 minutes on TV to do that. It's the nature of these programs, which is why I hate debating hacks like you. And so he said, you know, so go back to your office. You read that testimony again. You tell me what I've just said is wrong. Well, that's a heck of a challenge. So I went back to my office and I actually did look at that testimony, thinking that I was going to prove Joe wrong. And it turned out it looked like he was right. So I went down the office, down the hallway, to talk to my colleague who had put that narrative together for the United States Senate in testimony. And I said, look, you know, I explained what had just happened on TV. And I said, what am I missing here? Because it seems like Joe's correct. Turns out I wasn't missing anything, and my colleague had intentionally forwarded a very misleading narrative about that testimony and about what James Hansen's climate projections have proved out to be. And that was really, you know, that was shocking to me, because I, you know, I, like everyone, we can't be experts in everything. And even though I was responsible for energy and environmental work at Cato. I'm not a climate scientist, but my colleague was. And it was very disturbing to find out that I was getting bad information and consciously misleading information. And that was one of the events that began to lead to my conversion from a climate skeptic to a climate realist, I guess you'd say.
Well, let's talk about that, because you mentioned this whole question of certainty and uncertainty and uncertainty versus dogmatism. And what I really liked about your piece was you put it in the context of thinking about climate risks the way we think about risk in other contexts, you know, risk management and what risk management is, and that risk management requires you to make preparations for a variety of outcomes. And this is important to me. Because and you know, sometimes when I listen, and I only listen maybe with half an ear, you know, to some of the partisans on all of this, there does seem to be this sort of, you know, arrogant dogmatism that we absolutely know what's going to happen. And you're willing to say we don't know what's going to happen. There's a pretty large range of what's going to happen, somewhere between, you know, 2.7 Fahrenheit degrees all the way up to 8.1. But that uncertainty doesn't mean that we shouldn't take aggressive action if we think of this in terms of risk management.
No, absolutely. I mean, risk management is not about discerning the optimal response to the most likely outcome of an action. It's about discerning the optimal response to the full range of possible outcomes from an action. And it may very well be that climate change proves to be a, you know, relatively modest event at the very low end of the distribution of possible outcomes. It's possible. And that's not like a deep secret in climate science. You can see these uncertainties discussed in full detail in these various IPCC reports. So it's not like this is, you know, a hidden matter of knowledge that is kept out of the debate. But it can also lead to the higher end scenarios as well. And there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty in climate science because we don't have data points to repair to here. This is a one-off experiment. We've seen the atmosphere loaded with greenhouse gases at this level before, but mankind was not on this planet then. And it takes a while for the planet to adjust to this loading. And in those days, by the way, there was no Arctic ice sheet. That's eventually what happens with today's concentrations of greenhouse gases. Won't happen tomorrow, but it will happen eventually if past is prologue. But we've never seen a world in which these greenhouse gases were loaded as quickly into the atmosphere as we've done through industrial combustion of fossil fuels. So we don't know exactly how this is going to play out. In financial markets or other markets where we run into risks like this, we have, you know, information to fall back on. We have experiences, we have data points to better inform our thinking on this. But in the climate arena, we have a paucity of data. And that's what makes this rather scary, because we know just from basic physics that if you put CO2 in the atmosphere, it's going to warm the atmosphere. We know that. We've known that for more than 100 years. Anybody who wants to, you know, spend 5 minutes on Google and denialist websites and try to argue differently is picking a fight with, you know, basic fundamental physics. And I'm pretty sure that they're going to lose that argument. So we know that's going to happen. But how much warming we're going to see and what tipping points might we inadvertently cross and what low probability, high impact scenarios we're trafficking in, a lot of these things are very unclear. But given the fact we only have one planet and the tail risks involved are every bit as catastrophic as offered by people like Al Gore and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I mean, they're not making that stuff up. That really is in play. I don't know for certain if it's going to play out, but it's one of the possible outcomes. We have to take that seriously if we're going to be engaged in risk management.
You're saying essentially, if I'm reading this correctly, that the risk of doing nothing is much, much greater and has much worse consequences than the risks of doing something that may turn out to be an overreaction.
Absolutely. I mean, so what happens, for instance, if we remove fossil fuels from the United States economy when we move to low carbon, you know, zero carbon energy, whether it's, you know, it'll probably be a mix of wind energy, solar energy, hydropower, probably some nuclear power thrown in. What's the worst that happens? Okay, the worst that happens is we have somewhat higher cost energy than we might have had prior to the transition. That's a risk. And we do know that this transition will cost money. How much is, you know, if you look at the modeling exercises about, you know, what this would really cost, we're looking somewhere between 0.2% of GDP and maybe 1% of GDP a year. If the median scenarios for climate change play out, we're talking about losses of about 3% of GDP per year, which are, you know, more than three times the cost of action. But let's say that climate change proves to be an absolute non-issue and we've gone down that green energy road. What's the worst that happens? Well, we can reverse course if we find out that climate change was an overwrought concern. We can bring fossil fuels back into the economy and remedy the high-priced energy that we're consuming in that fashion. And but we'll also get a benefit. I mean, after all, about 200,000 people a year in the United States die or die early because of air pollution that comes from fossil fuels. And we know that it's expensive to address because, you know, the only way to address is to get rid of fossil fuels. And that hasn't been a strong enough argument to persuade Republicans or anybody outside of the environmental movement. But if we decarbonize, we do save those 200,000 lives that otherwise would have been lost to an early death. Those are not insubstantial things. And if you actually price out the value of a life, as we do through regulatory exercises and other arenas of public policy, it looks like there's really the what they call co-benefits to a policy of decarbonization are pretty strong, even if climate change proves to be a relative non-issue. But let's say we go the road of not acting, and it turns out that the tail risks come true, and that we actually see the high impact scenarios of climate change play out. Well, then we're really in trouble because it's hard to reverse that. I mean, it costs a tremendous amount of money to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, and it doesn't remove easily. And so the costs associated with the reversal are very great. And a lot of the damages done by climate change are going to be in the rearview mirror before we have a chance to act. I mean, we're already seeing it today. So there's really, and there's no good upside to this. I mean, sometimes you'll hear climate skeptics say, but we're, you know, CO2 is plant food. We're going to have more trees and, you know, thicker gardens. You know, what good does it do you if those additional acres are underwater? I mean, there's a lot of other things that happen to, or if they're burned to a crisp because the California wildfires really never end now. These are just like regular parts of the Western environment. So, you know, just looking at it from with that sort of perspective, again, from a risk management perspective, it seems to me a relatively no-brainer that we ought to hedge.
Except politically, I'm going to push back a little bit because you know what the argument is going to be, that you have these theoretical risks and theoretical benefits, but when it comes into an election campaign, people are going to say, okay, well, here is the risk management to the economy. This is going to cost the economy a great deal of money. And in particular, it is going to cost X hundreds of thousands of jobs. We just saw an election down in Australia where the Labor Party was expected to win that election. And they were pushing a rather bold climate agenda. And then they had a stunning defeat when it turned out that a lot of blue-collar labor voters figured, hey, I'm sorry, that's my job. I am not going along with all of that. So what is the, you know, you put it in terms of risk management. I think a lot of conservative critics would say, okay, but also let's talk about cost benefit. Are we willing to tube the economy based on these possibilities in the future? And what is the response to that?
Well, you know, that you put your finger on exactly the problem. It's the case for action is not a particularly intellectually challenging argument to make. It's a challenging political argument to make. But, you know, what we're finding here is that it's easy to identify the lost jobs in a decarbonization strategy, right? We're going to lose coal miners, say, in Kentucky. Those are easy people to identify and put a face, you know, put a face to and put on camera, and they're easily mobilizable because they know what's coming. But what you don't see are the jobs that are lost through non-action because they're spread throughout the economy. If the costs of non-action are triple the cost of action, believe me, there will be lost jobs, lost productivity, and higher prices associated with that. But they're a lot more invisible. They're hard to discern. And even today, you've got people on the right who argue climate change isn't happening, despite with our very eyes, we can see it happening. So that's the real challenge. But I don't think it's an insurmountable one for two reasons. One, conservatives are perfectly willing to hedge against risks in the future, even low probability risks, with significant resources. I know that because that's what the war on terror is all about. We spent $5 or $6 trillion since 9/11 chasing Islamic fundamentalism around the world. Why do we do that? Not because, you know, the very existence of crazed Islamic militants in some distant country necessarily disturbs us. It's because we're afraid that they may get their hands on a nuclear or biological or chemical weapon someday and engage in mass killing. That's a low probability, high impact scenario, right? It's probably not going to happen, but it could happen. And so what do? We spend $5 or $6 trillion and launch a series of wars to try to reduce the possibility of that happening. That's not unlike a story about climate change, right? I mean, the costs of doing something about climate change are not too distant from the costs of doing something about Islamic fundamentalism on the scale that we have been spending money to combat it since 9/11. The only difference that I see is that the costs of climate change are actually more likely to occur and more dangerous than the costs associated with slipping up and allowing another 9/11 at some point in the future to play itself out. So conservatives are perfectly willing to embrace this policy if they really believe the risks are real. And I think that when, you know, we can have a lot of conversations about risk management, and I did so in that piece, and I think they're very persuasive. But ultimately, on the right, these arguments are probably not going to resonate with a lot of people until they honestly believe that climate change is not some cooked up leftist hallucination that justifies destroying the free market economy. As long as they believe that, you are not going to likely see a lot of political support on the right for climate action, no matter how, you know, no matter how powerfully or elegantly we might argue risk management stories in the bulwark.
Okay, so but right now the face of climate action is AOC. It used to be Al Gore, now it's AOC, and the Green New Deal with its radical radical proposal to upend the economy. You are not a fan of the Green New Deal, and I guess I would argue that the presence of the Green New Deal is actually making the task that you're outlining much, much more difficult, because it's raised the bar and said, look, if you really want to do something about this, and this is what the other side is proposing, a lot of people are going to roll their eyes, they're going to shrug their shoulders, and going to say, okay, I am out. So what's wrong with the Green New Deal based on your risk management model?
Yeah, if you want to really go chapter and verse, if you Google Jerry Taylor and Green New Deal, the lead hit you're going to get is an 11,000 word essay we published on our website a few weeks ago, where I tore that the Green New Deal stem to stern. I did it as a friend of climate activists, because I believe that all of the urgency offered by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not misplaced. It's correct. But the reason that I'm dubious about the Green New Deal is that it is an attempt to port in, quite literally. I don't mean to, you know, I'm not trying out for the next year's CPAC or to be a speechwriter for Sebastian Gorka. But it really is porting in every single last bullet point of the Democratic Socialists of America campaign platform. It does that quite literally. It addresses union power. It addresses homelessness. It addresses, you know, it calls for free education. It calls for free housing. It calls for, you know, universal health care. It calls for dealing with discrimination against indigenous people. It calls for a return to family farms. I mean, it's absolutely amazing how much non-climate material is thrown into that thing. So that's and that's one of the real difficulties we have here, because a lot of conservatives are reluctant to have this conversation or entertain the possibility that climate change is real, because they think that if I concede that, I now have to tear up the entire industrial free market economy, do something about it. And what the Green New Deal says is, yeah, you're right. Now, it's not correct. You don't have to dismantle capitalism, free markets, or, you know, radically unleash government to address climate problems. You can do it through price signals. You can harness capitalism to do this fairly easily. But you are reinforcing the conservatives that if you're serious about climate change, you concede the need for action, then what you're doing is opening the door to the elimination of the free market as we know it. And while that's a feature, not a bug, for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, perhaps, and the Democratic Socialists of America and the hard left progressive wing of the Democratic Party, it is not a very good selling point for anyone outside of that community. So, no, I think it makes my job in trying to talk sense to people on the center and the center right and the conservative world a heck of a lot more difficult.
So who's getting this right now? Are there any center right figures, Republican leaders, who you think understand this issue?
There are some. There are more that understand this issue than you'd think. I mean, we spend a lot of time at the Scannon Center on Capitol Hill. We have an old-fashioned view of what think tanks ought to do. It's the old Heritage model. We roll up our sleeves and get to know members and their staff and committee staff and work with them in helping them draft legislation, consider amendments, and provide what we call a legislative subsidy to them because they're terribly understaffed. And so we are free staff help, and that's what we do for a living. And that's how you build influence in the governing networks of Washington. So we're up on the Hill quite a bit on climate issues and immigration and, you know, housing and other issues, healthcare. So we deal with a lot of things in the Scannon. But, you know, climate is one of our big issues. So we talk to a lot of members. We talk to most of the members of the Republican caucus in the House and the Senate. And far more of them behind closed doors will concede that climate change is real. Let's not make believe that it is indeed caused by humans and that we have to do something about it. Far more will concede that when the cameras aren't on them or the microphones aren't on than you would believe. But, you know, whether they're willing to concede that in private is one thing. Whether they're willing to do something in public is entirely another. There's no window of opportunity for Republicans right now to act. There's a high cost to it. You immediately flag yourself as an enemy of the Koch network if you do act, and the Trumpist wing of the Republican Party. So an if and until a political window of opportunity for climate action actually occurs, you're going to see these Republicans on the sidelines. So, but that having been said, there have been some who've jumped and been very good. One of my political heroes in the Republican Party is former Congressman Carlos Curbelo from Florida. He represents large sections of Miami and Dade County, and he just lost a seat in the last general election. Now, he had sponsored a rather ambitious carbon tax proposal that would pay for a major infrastructure program in the United States. I thought that was sensible. We worked with him on that piece of legislation. It's called the Market Choice Act. So he's a man who's been tremendous. Pat Rooney from Pennsylvania has likewise been a tremendous voice on this issue. Episodically, Jeff Flake was good. Jeff Flake supported a carbon tax, and he was a House member and a Senate member. In the past, and I think before he left office, he had forwarded something on that front. So you can find, you know, good Republican voices. Bob Inglis is a tremendous Republican voice. He lost his seat in 2010 yeah. to a Tea Party challenge.
And there's a bad trend here.
Yeah, I mean, these are but you know, I can guarantee you Carlos Curbelo didn't lose his seat from supporting carbon tax. His Democratic opponent was calling for more aggressive climate action than what he was forwarding. So that would not have explained the loss of his seat. But the fact is that, you know, in American politics, at the federal level anyway, you would have to work really hard to find a Republican who lost a seat because they didn't endorse climate action sufficiently. But you can find Republicans who have lost their seats because of a conservative primary challenge that was powered in part by anger over their support for climate action.
Right.
Bob Inglis is a classic example of that. And until that dynamic changes, I don't think we're going to see the Republican Party at large change.
You're raising a very interesting question here. And when we actually started with this, which is the pressure for ideological conformity and the ways in which that conformity is enforced, that if you break ranks on certain issues like this one, you are going to be excommunicated, you're going to be primaried, you might be out of a job because there are certain orthodoxies you're not allowed to change your mind about. On the other hand, we've seen the vast mainstream of the Republican Party change its tune on other issues like free trade, deficits, you know, fiscal conservatism, almost at the drop of a hat. Right. I mean, so you could be anti, you know, for free trade for the last 20 or 30 years. And then 5 minutes ago, you decided that, yes, I'm all in for this trade war and not pay any price. You have had people who built their entire career warning about the debt and the deficit who are now presiding over $1 trillion a year deficits. No political price whatsoever. So what is the rule other than simply what the tribe demands? Because clearly there have been people who've been able to change their minds without any cost, but you're absolutely right. You change your mind on this particular issue, And you put your political standing very much at risk in the modern Republican Party.
Yeah, you're exactly correct about that. One thing we know, though, a lot of people have a hard time accepting this or are unaware of the scholarship on this issue, is that most people, even the most partisan members of the Democratic and Republican Party, have very lightly held opinions about public policy. But they have very strong commitments to the party, to their, you know, political community. And because of that, whoever runs the party kind of dictates the party line and can sweep away old orthodoxies at the drop of a pen. So a Republican Party that used to be a rather hawkish party under George W. Bush is now a party that sounds like Dennis Kucinich when it comes to overseas engagement. A party that used to be the free trade party is now the protectionist party and endorsing tariffs against China that approached the levels we saw in the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act in the 1930s, which is just amazing to me. But what it tells you is that if some Republican leader in the future were to take command of the party and wanted to do something about climate change, the party would likely follow there. In fact, if Donald Trump had, I guarantee you the Republican Party would have had no problem endorsing climate action if it was the position of Donald Trump. We saw, in fact, we don't have to speculate about that. Only a bit more than a decade ago, this party nominated John McCain.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mention him. Yeah.
On climate action, a cap and trade program, no less. And while he didn't win over everyone of the GOP on climate action, it was not enough to keep him from getting the nomination. And in fact, you saw a lot of Republicans like Marco Rubio, you know, come around and reluctantly endorse a cap and trade program because it seemed inevitable to them that we were going to see something like that. Newt Gingrich was on TV doing ads with Nancy Pelosi endorsing aggressive climate action. Pat Robertson was on TV doing the same. So, you know, at that time, the GOP was really different. And the 2008 Republican platform that was adopted at that convention that nominated John McCain could have been written by Sheldon Whitehouse and Hillary Clinton when it came to climate. I mean, it called for the elimination of fossil fuels using market forces. It was amazing. Fast forward a decade now, and anybody who would said anything like that, you know, would probably be, subject to alt-right death threats. But it didn't used to be that way. And it can go that way again. I mean, when Donald Trump leaves power, and someday he will, by hook or crook, the Republican Party will have new leadership. And whether that new leadership is sensible on climate or not, if I were a betting man, I wouldn't immediately bet on a new John McCain to come on the political scene. But it's not impossible to imagine at all. The three most popular Republican politicians in America are all realists and on climate change, right? They're Larry Hogan in Maryland and Charlie Baker in Massachusetts and Phil Scott in Vermont. These are the three most popular politicians in America. They happen to be moderate Republicans who care about climate change. You can imagine a world in which the party moved because its leadership moved.
You know, you actually can. That's a really interesting point. I mean, and you've seen it move on issues like infrastructure. Speaking of changing positions, though, in the few minutes we have left, moving off the climate issue, because you've got me thinking about this, watching what's happened to the Freedom Caucus, for example, which not that long ago was actually concerned about freedom. On fiscal conservatism, deficits, and all of that. This week, their obsession is condemning Justin Amash, condemning one of their members for exercising his freedom to criticize the president and call him out for his illegal activities. It really is extraordinary to watch the devolution of the caucus, but also an indication of what's happened, I think, to the Republican Party, that it's really become, you know, really much very much in service of an individual, in service of partisan advantage. And as you point out, the ideas and principles are very, very turn out to be very lightly held.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Freedom Caucus was born during the Obama administration. And one of its animating concerns was the erosion of congressional power to an increasingly Caesarian White House. And yet today you have a Freedom Caucus that has no problem with the president deciding that he doesn't have to pay any attention to congressional subpoenas and that he has executive power to just declare national emergencies pretty much at will. And that's just absolutely jaw-dropping amazing. So Yeah, I mean, I know Justin Amash. I think he's I don't always agree with Justin Amash. I'm a former libertarian, not a present libertarian like he is. But that said, he represents the most honorable side of what that world aspired to be, could have been, maybe someday in the future can be again, a principled libertarian conservative concern for individual liberty, freedom, the rule of law, and a free republic. But the Freedom Caucus today is nothing of the kind. It's an authoritarian caucus. And that's not news to anyone except for its most blind devotees.
You know, there's a danger of being numbed, and we use the word normalized too much. But, you know, the point you make about the caucus being formed to push back against the, you know, the Caesarization of the executive. I just remember that moment when I was not as shocked as I should have been when they came out in favor, when they all went down the line in favor of the emergency order by the president. It was an extraordinary moment. But the thing about Justin Amash is how unusual he is. The striking thing about him is that he really is a political unicorn right now. And people react so angrily to that here's somebody who actually has ideas. As you say, I don't always agree with his ideas, but that he's willing to take a principled position, and how completely out of step he is with everybody else in politics today, at least on the right.
Yeah, you know, I wrote an essay. I think the first time I was on your podcast, we were discussing an essay I wrote against ideology and my departure from that world. But there, you know, to be fair, there is an upside to ideologues and ideologies, in that they ideologues tend to put their principles and their ideology first and foremost, and they're willing to make great sacrifices for it. And that's Justin Amash. He truly and honestly believes in individual liberty, autonomy, and all of the creeds of the libertarian movement. And if it means, if he's got to choose between giving those up or giving up his seat in Congress, he'll take his chances giving up his seat in Congress, because he means it. He really means it. Now, look at an alternative to Justin Amash, Rand Paul. He was the great champion of the libertarian world when I was at Cato. There were articles about the libertarian moment with Rand Paul's face everywhere. And he was going to be the great savior. He was the face of the Tea Party. And for a while, he was a top contender for the Republican nomination in 2016. Look what's happened to Rand Paul. How firmly has he held on to his principles? How important has he held his ideology when it was stress test by political considerations? Well, he threw him under the bus as fast as he could to remain in the good graces of the Republican Party. So Justin Amash is, you know, oddly enough, as much as I'm suspicious of ideology and ideologues, Justin Amash is an example of maybe some of the positive sides of that. And Rand Paul is an example of what happens if you hold your principles too lightly. You get a politician like that.
I've seen you tweet on this, and I do think that it's going to be very difficult for anyone to mount a primary challenge against Donald Trump. I hope somebody does do it. But Justin Amash could really pose a problem for Donald Trump as a third-party candidate, particularly given the fact that he's very popular in the state of Michigan, certainly popular in his own district, and would be running on issues that would appeal to Trumpist voters, the kind of voters that would otherwise vote for the Republicans. So as a third-party candidate, Justin Amash, I think, would pose some dangers. I think it is kind of interesting, the speculation that we've seen over, and I don't know whether that's what his motivation is or whether he's interested in all of that, but he's certainly become plausible in the last several days.
Yeah, I'd go so far as to say that if Justin Amash jumps into the race, you can put a fork in Donald Trump in a second.
Really?
Won't happen. The reason for that is that in the best case for Donald Trump is that this will be a close election. There's no way he's going to run away with this election. That'll be a very close election that looks like the last one. In that world, having a viable, publicly known, politically experienced candidate, either carrying the Libertarian Party banner or as an independent, would be the kiss of death for him. Gary Johnson pulled 3% of the vote nationally and nearly cost Trump the election, because almost all those votes otherwise would have gone to the Republican candidate in the race. Justin Amash is a guy who is not going to draw from the Democratic Party. He is pro-life. I think he's a life at the begins at conception man. He's got a high rating with the NRA. He is fiercely against gun control. In other words, you can't find reasons to turn away from Justin Amash if you're a conservative. Co-founder of the Freedom Caucus, probably an all-star life number at Club for Growth and Freedom Works as far as tax cuts and limited government. He just so happens to not believe in authoritarianism and the cult of personality. So it'd be easy for Republicans to say, look, man, I can't vote for Kamala Harris or Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. But geez, Donald Trump is just I can't pull that lever. I'm going to vote for Justin Amash. If he were to do what Gary Johnson did in the last race and just do it a little bit better, which I think he definitely would, even if instead of, 3%, he gets 4 or 5%. That's enough to put Donald Trump to bed. So I think if Republicans put in the race, they're committing suicide.
And you also point out, though, that percentage point will probably those percentage points would come from a more conservative base than maybe Gary Johnson was able to appeal to. And that this is the real vulnerability of Donald Trump, to face an opponent running at him from his own right. And that's something that he ought to be very concerned about. Jerry Taylor, thank you so much for all the time joining us again on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Charlie. It's always delightful to be on your program.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.